Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your sources and unearth the most fascinating nuggets of knowledge. Today, we're diving deep into the life of a titan whose name really became synonymous with Hollywood's golden age, but his story is far more complex than maybe that glittering facade of the movies he produced suggests. We're talking about Louis B. Mayer.
Absolutely. The man who built an empire, shaped a culture, and, well, in many ways, really defined what it meant to be a movie star.
Yeah.
Louis B. Mayer wasn't just, you know, a studio head. He was a force of nature, a true architect. He shaped not only Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM, but the very fabric of American entertainment.
Okay.
So our mission today is to kind of unravel the man behind that iconic roaring lion, explore his incredible, almost improbable rise, his often controversial methods,
right,
and the enduring, really multifaceted legacy he left behind.
Get ready to understand how one man's relentless ambition transformed an entire industry and created the star system we still recognize today that, you know, carefully constructed mythology and public image that turned actors into these global icons.
You're about to discover a figure who was, well, simultaneously revered and reviled, a true self-made mogul whose impact echoes through cinema even now.
Definitely.
So how did this incredible origin story begin?
Yeah.
Louis B. Mayer, born Lazar Mayer, right? Hailed from the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
Grew up in incredibly poor circumstances in St. John, New Brunswick, Canada.
Right. Family spoke mostly Yiddish at home.
Okay.
And he famously quit school at just 12 years old.
12.
Yeah, 12, to work with his father in a scrap metal business.
Wow.
And, you know, this early struggle, this absolute fight for survival, it's absolutely crucial to understanding the relentless drive that propelled him throughout his life.
Makes sense.
The actress Anne Rutherford, who worked under him at MGM, she once observed, "If anybody on earth ever created himself, Louis B. Mayer did." He was a man who, coming from that poor immigrant background with, like, no formal education beyond elementary school, quite literally taught himself grammar, manners, and perhaps most importantly, the ambition to lift his family out of poverty.
He spent his early days roaming the streets with a cart, just collecting scrap metal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a powerful image. Shows you how deep that grit ran.
And he even remembered people who helped him early on, right? Like that
yeah.
tin business owner.
Yeah, John Wilson. Mayer considered him his first partner just for giving him some copper trimmings. And Mayer would place flowers on Wilson's grave in later years, just like he did on his mother's. Shows a certain loyalty, maybe.
Interesting. So from collecting scrap metal, he makes this truly surprising pivot. In 1907, he's just 20, leaves St. John for Boston, and eventually renovates this rundown 600-seat burlesque house in Haverhill, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
reopens it as his first movie theater, The Orpheum, in 1912. And get this, here's a detail that tells you a lot about his instincts.
Okay.
To overcome the building's unfavorable, maybe even scandalous reputation, he opens it not with some raucous show, but with a religious film, From the Manger to the Cross.
Wow. That's an astute move.
Hmm.
Shows his keen business acumen right from the start.
Yeah.
He understood his audience, how to position things.
God.
And what's fascinating is how quickly he scaled that success. Within just a few years, he owned all five of Haverhill's theaters, then created the Gordon Mayer Partnership, controlling the largest theater chain in New England.
And then came that truly bold, almost audacious move in 1914, netted him a fortune.
Oh, yeah, the birth of a nation rights. He paid D.W. Griffith $25,000 for the exclusive New England rights.
For a film he hadn't even seen.
Exactly. Hadn't seen it. But that gamble paid off spectacularly. Earned him over $100,000, which was just an enormous sum back then.
Incredible. And he didn't stop there. Used those earnings, partnered with Richard A. Roland.
Right, to create Metro Pictures Corporation in New York.
Then just 2 years later, moves his operations to Los Angeles, the burgeoning film hub, forms his own production company.
And he was already a significant player in this exciting, rapidly expanding industry. That meteoric rise, it's something else.
And that success paved the way for his most famous creation, the studio that would become synonymous with glamour and prestige. Right. April 1924, his company merges with two others, Metro Pictures and Samuel Goldwyn's Goldwyn Pictures Corporation.
Mm-hmm. To form Metro-Goldwyn, which, with Mayer's full blessing, very quickly became Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM.
And Mayer was named head of studio operations, a Lowe's vice president, reporting directly to Lowe's president, Nicholas Schenck.
Ah, Schenck.
Now, we know Mayer privately referred to Schenck as well.
Mr. Skunk.
Yes.
Yeah, that tells you something about their intense dislike for each other.
What was the root of that friction, do we know?
Well, it seems like a classic power struggle. Financial control versus creative vision. Schenck, head of the parent company, losing Schenck, he was focused on the bottom line, efficiency.
Okay.
Mayer, though, was deeply invested in the quality, the prestige of the film. So that sometimes meant, you know, significant spending.
Created constant tension, I bet. Budgets, artistic direction.
Exactly. But Mayer did have a brilliant partner in this new venture, the 24-year-old Irving Thalberg, made vice president in charge of production.
And this truly was a brilliant team, wasn't it? Like a perfect pairing.
It really seemed to be. Mayer took charge of the business, the finances, setting budgets, giving the final okay on productions.
Right.
Meanwhile, Thalberg, the boy wonder, he oversaw the artistic side, shaped the stories, managed the talent.
Director Joseph M. Newman summed it up perfectly, didn't he? Thalberg had the story mind, Mayer the business acumen.
Absolutely. Their complementary skills were undeniable. And their shared guiding philosophy was incredibly ambitious for the time.
Which was?
To make the best motion pictures they could at any cost. Even if it meant reshooting entire films from scratch.
Wow. Quality over immediate profit.
Pretty much. They prioritized quality, spectacle, prestige. And it worked. Profoundly. Within just 3 years of the merger, MGM was the most successful, most profitable, most glamorous studio in Hollywood.
They even poured resources into stars like Garbo, even in silent films.
Oh, yes. Lush settings, spectacular camera work. It was all part of that MGM pursuit of excellence.
Now, here's something that reveals a crucial dynamic. Their professional relationship was hugely successful, but it frayed over philosophical differences, right?
Yeah. Thalberg preferred more literary works, often darker. Mayer wanted broader, more wholesome crowd pleasers.
But Mayer's reaction to Thalberg's early death in 1936, Thalberg was only 37. It was incredibly profound.
It really was. He dedicated MGM's front office as the Thalberg Building, established the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award.
Which is still a huge deal in Hollywood today.
Absolutely. And his reaction wasn't just grief, it was also, you know, pragmatic. Recognizing the immense, irreplaceable talent he'd lost.
And many expected Mayer to stumble and fall without Thalberg, didn't they?
They did. But he defied those expectations, stepped fully into the role of head of production himself. And surprisingly, MGM continued to grow and thrive for another decade.
Like 1939, that golden year.
Oh, incredible year. The Wizard of Oz, Ninotchka, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and the distributed Gone with the Wind, just massive.
And at its peak in the 1940s, MGM was this sprawling empire, 185 acres.
Three separate entrances, 6,000 employees, its own private rail line.
And its own police force, 50 officers.
Yeah, bigger than the police force in Culver City itself, where the studio was located. Can you imagine? Anywhere from 16 to 18 pictures being shot at one time.
It's almost mind-boggling the scale, the ambition needed to manage that.
It really was. Not just a film studio. It was a self-contained city of dreams, running on its own infrastructure. A testament to Mayer's vision, his management capacity.
Okay, so one of Mayer's most significant lasting contributions, something we still see echoes of, was helping create the star system.
Right.
He famously declared, "The idea of a star being born is bourgeois. A star is made, created carefully, and cold-bloodedly built up from nothing, from nobody."
That's a pretty strong statement about control, isn't it?
It really is. Raises big questions about celebrity and control.
He meticulously scouted talents, Garbo, Hedy Lamarr, Greer Garson, offered the highest salaries in Hollywood. But in return, he expected absolute loyalty. Signed them to incredibly restrictive long-term contracts. Saw them as part of the MGM family.
He said he only looked for a face if it photographed well.
The studio would do the rest. Yeah. That meant hiring geniuses for makeup, hair, even surgeons to slice away a bulge here and there.
Wow.
And a whole army of coaches for fencing, walking, talking, everything. It was a factory, yes. But a factory designed to produce perfection, or their idea of it.
And his paternalism could be extreme, almost suffocating.
Oh, definitely. He was known for meddling deeply in actors' personal lives, telling them where to shop, dine, what doctor to see.
Even arranging marriages.
Reportedly, yes. It sounds like he really wanted to mold every single aspect of their public and private personas.
That's intense.
It is. And what's fascinating here are the wildly different experiences under his management. Really highlights his complexity.
Like Joan Crawford saw him as a father figure.
Right. Crawford said, "To me, L.B. Mayer was my father confessor, the best friend I ever had." Ricardo Montalban echoed that, saying Mayer really thought of the people under contract as his boys and girls.
But then you have others.
Far darker experiences. Elizabeth Taylor famously called him a monster.
Yeah.
and actress Esther Ralston claimed her career was sabotaged because she refused to sleep with him.
Those are disturbing accusations, and it goes further, doesn't it? The sexual abuse claims.
Yes, truly troubling accusations. Notably from Judy Garland in her unfinished autobiography.
Mm.
She described Mayer groping her, having meetings with her, seated on his lap, hands on her chest.
Terrible.
And Shirley Temple claimed he came on to her mother when Temple herself was only 12. It paints a very different, much darker picture of that paternal figure.
Definitely highlights the huge power imbalance in the studio system, the vulnerability of actors.
Absolutely. Yet despite these darker aspects, Mayer also famously tried to protect stars in crisis.
Like with Judy Garland later on.
Right. When she was struggling with addiction, mental health issues causing production delays and budget overruns, Mayer refused to cancel summer stock.
Hmm.
He said, "Judy Garland has made this studio a fortune, and the least we can do is to give her one more chance. If you stop production now, it'll finish her."
Hmm. Though eventually, her problems did lead to her being fired from Annie Get Your Gun.
Sadly, yes.
So given the accusations, how do we reconcile this protective side with the alleged abuses? Was it genuine care or just protecting assets?
It's a tough question. It goes right to the heart of his complexity. Probably a blend of both. He genuinely seemed to want the studio to nurture child stars for MGM's family-oriented films. They provided education, medical care on site.
And MGM had more child actors than any other studio, right? Coogan, Rooney, Garland, young Liz Taylor.
Exactly. So there was a system of care. But at the same time, the power he wielded was absolute, and that often led to abuse or the potential for it.
His nephew's quote seems to capture it.
Yeah, he was a giant. Were we afraid of him? Jesus Christ, yes. Captures that immense, almost intimidating presence he had.
Okay, beyond managing stars, Mayer had this very specific, almost ideological vision for the kind of films MGM would make.
Yes, very much so. He championed wholesome entertainment, strong family values.
Especially clear in the Andy Hardy series, right? Hugely popular.
Wildly popular. Mickey Rooney even got a special Oscar in 42 for furthering the American way of life through that role.
And Mayer's values were deeply held.
Incredibly clear and deeply held. He told screenwriter Frances Marion, "I worship good women, honorable men, and saintly mothers." He was apparently so serious about this, he once knocked director Eric von Stroheim to the floor for saying all women were whores.
Wow.
Mayer believed in glamour, spectacle, optimism, sentiment, aiming to comfort and entertain, not challenge.
He explicitly said he wasn't making pictures for critics.
Right. For Americans and all people to enjoy, showing America in the right light. That was his goal.
And his love for musicals truly shaped an entire genre.
Absolutely. He was anxious to make more musicals, had a hunch about songwriter Arthur Freed.
Asked him to be an associate producer on Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, an inspired decision, as it turned out. Freed's unit, just as Mayer hoped, went on to produce some of the best musicals ever made.
Like Singin' in the Rain, Meet Me in St. Louis.
And Oscar winners, An American in Paris, GG.
Wow.
These are widely seen as Mayer's greatest contributions to posterity.
Definitely classics.
Absolutely. Another crucial point that sheds light on him is his stance during World War II.
Okay.
Initially, he hesitated to make anti-Nazi films. There were significant economic fears. 30-40% of Hollywood's income came from Europe. Didn't want to jeopardize that.
Understandable from a business perspective, I guess.
Sure. But MGM eventually defied both the Hays Office Hollywood's own censorship body, which banned anti-Nazi films then.
Right.
And even U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, who urged studios to stop making anti-German films, thinking British defeat was imminent.
So Mayer pushed forward despite the risks, authorized films like The Mortal Storm and Escape in 39.
Yes, right as the war was gripping Europe. But his most impactful contribution, the one that really resonated, was Mrs. Miniver.
He personally convinced Greer Garson, who he'd discovered, to take that role.
He did. Told her she wasn't just playing a character, she was London. No, more than that, she was England.
Powerful framing.
And the film was a massive success. 6 Academy Awards, including Best Actress for Garson, top box office hit of 1942.
And it was more than just entertainment, right? It was seen as propaganda.
Incredibly powerful propaganda. President Roosevelt loved it. Winston Churchill loved it. Churchill famously sent Mayer that telegram,
claiming Mrs. Miniver is propaganda worth 100 battleships.
Exactly. It solidified Mayer's role beyond entertainment. As a shaper of public opinion, morale, during a critical time, he understood cinema's power.
But his politics weren't always universally admired. And he wasn't afraid to use the studio's power politically.
Not at all. He was an active Republican, served as California Republican Party chair in the early 30s.
And that aggressive political maneuvering using the studio's reach, it's an early example of how media empires could be leveraged politically, kind of resonates today.
A really powerful example happened during the 1934 California gubernatorial election. Mayer strongly opposed the Democratic candidate, Upton Sinclair.
Preferred the Republican, Frank Merriam.
Right. And to fight Sinclair's campaign, MGM and other studios deducted a day's pay from employees.
Wow.
Raising an anti-Sinclair fund of a staggering $500,000.
And they made propaganda films.
Yeah. Fake news reels.
Yeah.
Hired actors portraying bums and criminals, some speaking with foreign accents. Clearly designed to demonize Sinclair. It's a stark reminder of studio power extending far beyond the screen, right into politics.
Yeah, definitely. So after the war, the golden age starts to dim for MGM.
It does. The studio faced declining profits. And Mayer, the big picture man who loved spending for quality, he struggled with demands from Lowe's, the parent company, to cut expenses.
And the hiring of Dor Skerry as VP in charge of production in 48, that was a sign of shifting times.
A clear sign. Seen by many, including Mayer, as a direct threat to MGM's classic style of musicals and comedies that he championed, Skerry favored more message-driven films.
So this really marked the twilight of his direct influence.
Pretty much. The industry was changing, audiences were changing, the old guard was being challenged.
And by mutual consent with Lowe's, Mayer resigned from MGM in August 1951.
On his final day, reportedly, a red carpet was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
Executives, actors, staff applauded him, recognizing it as the end of an era.
Actor Turhan Bey declared, "In every meaningful way, it was the end of Hollywood." That's quite a statement.
It is, a truly symbolic moment.
Mayer tried new ventures after MGM, right? Cinerama.
Yeah, he became chairman of Cinerama in 52, that revolutionary widescreen process. He hoped to produce Paint Your Wagon using it, but without success.
Also tried an unsuccessful takeover of MGM.
He did, before his death from leukemia in 1957. But despite those later struggles, his legacy is just immense, undeniable.
Variety magazine summed it up well.
They did, stating he was probably the greatest single force in the development of the motion picture industry, who brought it to the heights of prosperity and influence it finally attained.
And he got that honorary Oscar in 51.
Right, for guiding MGM with foresight, aggressiveness, and with a real desire for taste and quality, and for bringing the star system into full flower, a fitting acknowledgement.
Director Clarence Brown compared him to Hearst.
Said Mayer made more stars than all the rest of the producers in Hollywood put together. He never wrote or directed, never pretended to.
But he understood movies and audiences fundamentally.
Exactly. Profoundly shaping not just entertainment, but how America viewed itself.
And that understanding of America, his love for it, that was a driving force, wasn't it?
It really seemed to be. Spencer Tracy captured it beautifully at Mayer's funeral. The story he wanted to tell was the story of America, the land for which he had an almost furious love, born of gratitude.
That furious love, it's powerful imagery.
Apparently, he'd be stoked with extra exuberance for days afterward, just listening to John Philip Sousa's patriotic music. Paints a picture, you know? A man seeing his work as deeply tied to the American spirit.
And his influence is recognized in so many ways. Canada's Walk of Fame, street names, university theaters.
Like the Mayer Theater at Loyola Marymount.
Mm.
And even the Louis B. Mayer Research Laboratories at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute shows the breadth of his impact far beyond Hollywood.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this? Louis B. Mayer, this poor immigrant turned self-made titan, he truly built the most prestigious studio in Hollywood from the ground up.
Yeah.
He shaped the very definition of a movie star, created these beloved musical classics, and even significantly influenced American culture and wartime morale.
His story is just such a powerful reminder that behind the silver screen glamour, the iconic images, there were these complex, often contradictory figures, their personal struggles, huge ambitions, moral ambiguities, all deeply intertwined with their groundbreaking achievements.
He's an executive genius.
A paternal figure, sometimes disturbingly so.
A fierce, even brutal businessman.
And just a complicated man who left this indelible mark on history and popular culture.
His nephew, Gerald Mayer, simply said of him, he was a giant.
And that's undeniable, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So the next time you see that roaring MGM lion, maybe consider not just the incredible films introduced, but the fiercely driven, often controversial, and undeniably patriotic man who stood behind it all. Louis B. Mayer forever changed how we tell stories, how we experience celebrity, and really how we view ourselves as a culture. His legacy is this incredible tapestry woven with threads of glamour, genius, and deep, often unsettling human complexity.